Hey, what's going on, everybody? And welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We are recording on the eve of Thanksgiving, or a couple of eves before. It's Tuesday night, November the 26th. I am Vlad Sedler, joined as always by my man, Boom 62, Jason Anthony. What's up, Jason?
What up, Vlad? You starting to fast already? Getting ready for Thanksgiving?
Oh, when you say fast, I'm always thinking in terms of draft. So no, actually I am a fast draft on Wednesday night and Wednesday night Gladiator. Gialdi and some others will be there.
You're a nut, man. I don't know how many drafts you're doing, but it's too many already, but it's never enough either, is it?
No. And of course we talked about it the last couple of weeks. I've started early because getting the rankings up and being able to battle test that and put the best that I can out right now is important. Really, the only way to do that is through experience. And honestly, the Gladiators, that season is going to end at some point soon, right? It's going to be at the end of January. I think they're maybe half filled, whatever 1,000 leagues that they're going to fill. And so, so just getting it done now. And not 1,000 leagues, maybe 1,000 people is what it is. Yeah. Anyways, we're just drafting right now. It's all good. And talking about stuff. So, Jason, we have a very special guest, don't we?
Oh, we are excited to have him too. But before we introduce our special guest, kudos to getting Bob Nightingale on last week. That's a pretty cool guest to have on with the fantasy community. Getting an actual baseball insider to come on and talk a little ball with you. That was definitely kudos to you for pulling that guest. But we have an equally impressive guest today, I would say.
More than
equal. I mean, different ways. I consider this gentleman a friend, and I don't know Bob, so I guess he will be more. So I'll go ahead and let you introduce our superstar guest here.
Yeah, let's keep it simple. He is, in my mind, and in probably most people's, the majority is the best fantasy baseball player in the land. At Phil Dussault 27 on the X, not yet on Blue Sky, but I'll get him on there soon. Phil Dussault, what's up, Phil?
Hey, I'm good. How are you guys doing?
I'm fantastic. We got you on. We're going to talk some baseball.
What an intro. A lot to live up to.
What's that?
No pressure at all, Phil.
You guys gave me there. Keeps getting better every time I come on.
Well, here's the thing. If you're the best, there's only one way to go. Ways to go, right? It's down. We can only catch you.
So, we're going up, Vlad. He's not going down.
Yeah, exactly. We got Phil on here. The obviously anytime Phil is available or can come on, we jump at the opportunity. But specifically what got this episode brewing is the fact that the two of us nuts, Phil and I, decided to separately and then ending up in the same place. We both eyed the first online championship, the NFBC, the 12-team OC with the overall grand prize, I think $200,000, $150,000, whatever it is. Those usually started in January, but this year the NFBC opened them earlier and basically let the first one open in November and as a slow draft. So there will be some of these slow drafts. So Phil and I both just ended up there, saw each other in the draft lobby. He's like, hey, you're in this one. And it ended up being both of our CLQs. And for those that don't know, that is the Champions League qualifier that Batflip Crazy Toby had created last year. It's been a phenomenal success. A couple hundred people in that. We have the first round of qualifiers for 2025, and they'll all be drafting live in Las Vegas this March. And these are both of our CLQ teams, which is a little crazy considering they're still 3 months or 2 months before even spring training.
Yeah, I thought Phil was a little smarter than that because I understand Phil's a great fantasy player, but I don't think he knows what he's getting into playing against the Roto Gut and 12 teamers. Vlad is kind of a beast to come in those. So it'll be fun to see how you guys do in that. Like I said before we got on air, you guys are both crazy, but I love you both.
I've seen Vlad's record. I know he's good, and when I saw them, I'm like, huh, should I stay in there? And I think in the past that might have helped out, but I'm like, this year I'm like, hey, I'm doing this for fun. I did my DCCLQ already as well. I just want to have fun with this. So whoever wants to compete against me, bring it, and we'll have some fun. And if I qualify for 2026, then great. If not, then I had some fun trying. So that's the goal this year.
And we'll dig into it in a bit. But the great part about this is the first Fab League of the year, right? So we can make mistakes. We can lose guys. I mean, obviously you don't want to have your first three picks be go down before opening day, but there is a very quick recovery on a lot of this and a lot of fab all season long. And of course it's a 12 teamer. So you have a deeper pool to choose from, but yeah, that'll be fun. We'll get into it. And it was really, really fun to draft that one with you. But you know, jumping into some things we're going to talk about today, we'll talk about that, that 12 team online championship. We will discuss some free agent rumors, some recent MLB news stuff that's been hitting. And then of course, with the MLB winter meetings coming up, you know, some of the rumors there and then some draft strategy as well. But Phil, wanted to ask you, so now that you're drafting a little bit differently this year than in past years, right? Like you've started earlier and you're working without your magic formula right now, right? Or is that still already set?
No, it's not set. I'm kind of testing them behind the scenes and I plan to bring them out in Vegas. So any draft I do until then will be a little more gut. For my DC and for this OC, I used mainly Steamer with like a little bit of my projections from late last season and then some playing time adjusted. And then a lot of time it's just like looking at the next, I'm just doing still drafts right now. So just looking at the next 5-10 players in my rankings in ADP, searching them, looking on Fangraphs, things like that. And then just choosing based on that. So nothing really scientific, but I've never really drafted baseball that way. So it's different. It's fun. I'm enjoying it. And being able to talk openly about these guys, whether it's with you guys on Discord or just drafting, not having to hide any players because I don't even know who I'll like in March. It just makes it fun. And I'm enjoying it. So I think that's the goal of this hobby. So I'm just going on for the ride.
Careful, Phil. You might get an emotional attachment at some point to these guys.
Well, I was gonna say, what happens if come, you know, the end of the season, and we obviously you don't want this to happen because all of your massively large money teams are going to be the ones drafted in March. But like, what if just the overall results of these early quote unquote gut teams outperform your other teams? Might you reassess your philosophy?
I'm just going to destroy the system and go go back old school. I don't know. I think there's something about, I think I've been playing this for long enough that I have a pretty good idea of who the values are right now. And a lot of it, at least in my DC, a lot of it was, hey, I think this guy's going to be going three rounds earlier in March. So when it was between a few guys, I was leaning towards those guys. So like, I think the teams I'm building right now are going to be hard to build in March. So that's kind of what I was going for, in these drafts.
That's exactly what it is. And especially now before even the big dominoes have fallen, like Juan Soto hasn't signed yet. And then all the remaining dozens upon dozens of free agents. I mean, the market adjusts and will jump a guy that's, you know, 300 ADP to 200 off of just the smallest signing. Oh, this guy's going to Cincinnati, or this, you know, the pitcher who pitches in Cincinnati is now going to like San Francisco. Like that stuff kind of stuff moves the needle. So just, you know, think about it. Like, I'm not trying to just sell everybody, hey, you should be drafting now before you're ready. But the values, it's like a sea galore. It's like, you know, what people hundreds of years ago when they were discovering new land, that's like kind of what this is. Because especially as you get deeper in the draft, you're getting in the 300s, 400s, there are these gems, these unearthed gems that you just, you know, the experience I can tell these players are going to move up. Phil, I know you and I, we've been doing the 1K DCs for some time. I showed you my team and you know, my results, and it was a team that had the 1-1, and it had Acuna, it had Senga, had a bunch of busts in the first five or six rounds, and it placed. That team came in third in the league, got paid, and it was really because of all the, you know, crochets, Ronaldo Lopez is later. It was like a 46th round Alec Burleson, 49th round Jesse Winker, like. These kind of things matter, and we can take advantage of it. Now is really the time. This stuff is going to change drastically.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other thing is with Steamer being the only projections there are right now, actually it's Zola as well and then yours, but like Steamer is the only one that we see on Fangraphs. So it's kind of the one that people are just looking at and putting in an SGP. You can I mean, at least in the two drafts I've done, you can notice there's at least one or two teams that are basically drafting off of Steamer straight up. And they're good, but like the projections are based on the rosters right now. Like for a while, Hunter Goodman was just up there. You could see it. Like he was the top value because people were thinking, oh, he might be the starting catcher. Then they signed Jacob Stallings and everything changes. So it, like part of it is just using common sense as to what we expect teams to do. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but we know teams are going to sign free agents. You know, if you draft someone with the Yankees, with the Mets, with the Dodgers, there's a good chance that someone is going to come in and take his job. So it's just kind of trying to predict things like that. I've been kind of trying to play it safe, avoid. I think I can kind of spot those guys that are at risk of losing playing time. So that's kind of what I've been going for. And also avoiding the, like, there's a bunch of, I think one of the things we do is we assume that everyone gets healthy in the offseason, which is far from true. Last year we had Matt McClain, we had CES, we had Edmund, who took like an extra 5 months to get back from his surgery. So avoiding players like that as well, I think is a big deal. Like even, was it Harper 2 years ago when it was really obvious he was going to have the surgery? Like in the first few drafts, he was going at the 1-2 turn. Like it's like something's, he's going to have surgeries that he's going to miss a couple of months. And as soon as it's announced, he moves down 5, 6, 7, 8 rounds. So it's kind of trying to predict things like that, which aren't necessarily out there. You just have to dig a little bit deeper. And sometimes you'll miss on guys, but I think just avoiding the big zeros is a big deal at this point.
Yeah. It really is. And that's a Tommy Edman World Series champion. So I don't want you to short Vlad and his Dodgers. You got to give him some credit here.
Damn straight.
You know, with it being, you guys were in the first ever online championship slow draft. I'd love to kind of talk your mindset through the picks, and doing that and how it impacted you differently than being on that 60-second clock. Do you think your drafts change at all? I'll start with Vlad actually. You know, how do you think the slow draft impacted your picks and your strategy in that draft, if at all?
I will tell you that I'm 100% a better drafter in a time draft where I do not, I'm essentially a classic overthinker. And if you give me too much time, I'm going to end up making the wrong decision or just really overthinking it. I feel like it's, you know, the gut, the instinct, the practice over the years just really has me more laser focused when I'm up against the clock. Same thing with deadlines, just, you know, that whole thing. And there are just a lot of things to think about here, right? You're on the clock for, these are 4 hour clock, 4 hour picks here, at least for this first OC slow. And obviously nobody took the 4 hours. I mean, the draft went at a pretty good pace, but there's a lot of things that you start to think about. You start to think about the fact that, hey, I'm right next to Waxman, who's in every draft, and Zach Waxman, and Phil is two spots away. And I'm thinking this is a CLQ, and I'm thinking, oh, there's still so many months away from the season. Oh, I really want this guy. This, you know, how am I mixing this in with my other possible CLQ exposure and my main event and my DC? There are just a million different things and synapses firing at all the same time. And at the end of the day, what I really tried not to do, which I think is a mistake that some drafters do, is you start to focus on what other players have or what they have going on, and you lose focus from what you're trying to build. And so, you know, if you just kind of take out of the equation that that's Phil two doors down over, you know, in the next slot and Waxman in the next one over, and just kind of focus on what you think is best for your build now, I think that's important. And we'll get into it more later, but also with as far as the end game and the type of players that I want to be targeting now, the type of players that I think now 3-4 months ahead of time might be going for big dollars in FAB.
In my case, once we get to March and I have my system ready and my sheets ready, most people who've seen me in Vegas know, like, I'm a fast drafter. I'll pick in 10, 15 seconds for pretty much all my picks. And there might be one or two in a draft where I get sniped for like twice in a row and I need the full minute, but it's like, I'm usually in the zone. I know what I want to do. At this point, it's, I'm not ready at all. So it had to be a slow draft for me. And there's even a pick I'm making in this draft where I had no intention of drafting the guy. I was just on my walk, went to my phone, pulled up draft. I'm like, hey, this guy's like one of the next five guys who's going to go. Let's research this guy. So I looked at prospect rankings, looked at quotes, all that stuff. All right, let's draft him. So I kind of enjoy that process. I enjoyed the draft. Like, drafting is fun. So just getting to research players, and even if it's four, like, I know people complain because it's 4 hours and sometimes people take a long time to pick, but like, I'm just like embracing it, just taking the time, looking for players. And I mean, when it was done, I was sad. So like, why rush through it? If it takes 2 or 3 weeks, then so be it. Like, come March, I prefer fast drafts. I think I might have an edge at making quick decisions and drafting a balanced team. But at this point, it was fun to do it this way.
Oh, I was very sad when it was over. I just really didn't want it to end. You're like, wait, this isn't 50 rounds. This is only 30. The other interesting part, and where you do have to consider your competition, is with figuring out who you can get now, especially when you're near the turn, and who you can get to come back around, and kind of understanding league mates' tendencies, and knowing that, hey, in the 18th round, like, hey, there are three guys I really love and I really have to have, and to figure out who I must take here, who might come back to me, what's best for roster construction, what's best for upside for this large overall contest, and what's also best for safety as far as the CLQ is concerned. So just so many factors to consider.
With it being a CLQ, did either you have a hesitancy clicking on the draft button with somebody, or was it just, all right, I'm picking this guy, we're moving on?
I had the opposite. I took forever deciding if, so I had missed out on a second closer. And not missed out, but I had Felix Bautista, who I took in the 6th round, and you know, I just kind of missed that boat on some of the other guys I liked. And so I'm like, okay, well, I don't know. I think I spent an entire evening trying to reach deep in my gut and through quotes and research to figure out, is even reached out to like a Cubs, my friend Sarah Sanchez, like, hey, what's going on there with is Porter Hodge, what's going to happen there with that situation? Because I like the pitcher, dug into the profile a little bit. It's a rookie. I don't know. Like, I don't think that Jed, they're going to sign anyone like massive, like a Tanner Scott, to straight up take over. But I'm also not completely convinced that Porter Hodge is just going to be the guy that's going to be smooth sailing all season long. And that's a risk better taken, I guess, in an OC. But I was debating forever between him and Ben Joyce as my RP2. And for the sanctity of safety, Xander Bogaerts, who had just been a few rounds past his ADP. And I still do kind of like Bogaerts this season. You know, he's a little older, but still in that lineup. I think that the lineup projections have him a little lower where I think he'll actually hit. So I think he's probably, you know, going to be more valuable than what it appears now. And I just could not for the life of me decide between those guys. I ended up taking Bogaerts. Thankfully, Joyce came back around for me on the way back. But long way of saying that I took Bogaerts for the, you know, to honor the sort of floor safety of a CLQ.
My toughest one was actually in the second round where I took Vlad while Corbin Carroll was still on the board. Like, I think any other draft I take Carroll, but this being an OC, I don't necessarily know if it's because of the CLQ or not, but I did want to go like as safe as I could in the first like 4 rounds of my first 4 hitters. Cause I know how important that is with an OC, and I know I can churn like the lowest, hitting spots, every week, but like those top hitters, I think you have to hit on them. Man, I just couldn't get out of my mind how bad Carroll was at the start of the year last year. So I'm like, Vlad feels safer. I'll take him here. But I think if I'm drafting like a main event in March, I go Carroll for the upside. Other than that, the other guy I really wanted was Rich Machado, because of how safe he feels. I was hoping he'd make it back to me in the 4th round. I couldn't pass up Jackson Merrill in the 3rd. I'm still wondering if I draft Machado there, does Merrill come back? I really wanted both there. But other than that, I kind of, after the first four rounds, I kind of just forgot about it and just drafted who I thought were the best players, because at that point in OC, it didn't matter quite as much. But I thought those first four rounds were key, so I was trying to go as safe as possible.
Yeah. Sorry, Vlad. I had to circle back to Ben Joyce real quick. You know, whenever you can get the Angels closer in those 12 saves, you got to lock it in pretty early. And I had to ask Phil something. Are you regretting that Kikuchi pick at all? Now they decided the Angels.
I actually forgot I made that pick when I pulled up the draft board for this pod. I'm like, damn it, I got Kikuchi there. I mean, yeah, it's not ideal. But then when I remember I had Raylo ahead, but I think I went Kikuchi just because I thought Lopez would make had a better chance of making it back, which he did, so I got both. But like as a whole, like basically Kikuchi doesn't look great there, but I look as a whole, my pitching, I'm happy with it. So he's just another arm in my on my roster, which I'll rotate in and out.
Well, I want to bring that up. I do want to bring up that kind of that stripe of yellow. We won't go over every guy there, but before we do, just kind of wrapping things up on the early rounds and just to paint the picture for those listening. So I was pick 9, Waxman was 10, Phil was 11. And so I was one pick away from Ellie De La Cruz, and I would have been just jumping up and down, or at least now, who knows at the end of the season. But so he went at 8, and so I took Kyle Tucker at 9, who I have, I believe, ranked 6th. So I took Tucker. Zach took Soto, Phil took Mookie Betts, and the guy at the turn took Julio Rodriguez and Francisco Lindor. After that, Phil came back with another solid floor pick with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. It's, hey, listen, it's floor and upside. Zach took Acuna, and then I took Corbin Carroll. So all three, right? All three of those starts look good on paper. My third round pick was Crochet. Zach went with a third outfielder right off the bat, Soto, Acuna, Duran, and then Phil, of course, you took Jackson Merrill there. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's what, at two hitters to start for each of us, just a little bit of a different build in these 15ers.
Yeah, I'd never do that in a 15-teamer. But the idea was to start with four hitters, which I did. If Crochet was there in the third, I might have considered it. If Logan Gilbert made it there in the third, I might have considered it as well. But as soon as those guys went, and I think like Merrill went way past his ADP. Harris, I think, is kind of going there right now, but I expect him to move up, especially with that steamer projection he's getting. So I think he's another guy who'll move up in the next few weeks, few months. So, three outfielders isn't ideal, but you take what the draft gives you.
Sorry to interrupt, guys, but breaking news on the pod, Blake Snell to the Dodgers.
There it is.
I hate baseball. I might even log off the podcast right now. I'm just distraught. 5 years, 182, I believe the numbers are. Yeah, that's a lot of money. And the rich get richer.
Do I pull up my tweet from 3 days ago that said Blake Snell was signing from the Dodgers and obnoxiously quote tweet it?
I don't know. You are nothing but humble, Vlad.
No.
Phil, what about the back-to-back catchers? Is that just CLQ? You wanted the stability?
No, that's purely OC strategy, and I do that in any OC. I think there is a big drop at catcher in this draft after Stevenson, Real Muto, and Vlad actually got the last one, Stevenson, round 14, and that's probably like at least a round or two later than he probably should have gone or where he's been going in DCs. And I think after that, there's just a big drop, and it's kind of like I think it's harder to churn catchers than it is any other hitting position. So getting those two guys was the goal.
And this is round 7 and 8. Sorry to interrupt, but just letting people know. 7 and 8.
Like, had I known that JTR would be there in the 14th, I'd probably wait for him, get him or Stevenson and at like the 13, 14 turn. But you never know how the draft is going to go. And I knew I wanted two good catchers. When the price felt right and there was no one else I really liked, it was an easy decision.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than the having to put in a week 22 fab you know, conditional bid, putting in a $2 Drew Romo in a 12 team. So, you know, avoid that if at all possible. And this, of course, is coming from the, you know, the catcher fader. And I say that, and I've kind of I've taken it to an extreme level just for the sarcasm, but I'm not opposed to drafting the early catchers. I very rarely, I'm on my eighth gladiator. I don't have any team so far where I have completely punted, both catcher spots. In most of those drafts, I do have guys past 250 ADP who I do like a lot, who I think, you know, are good values at this point. So I rarely take the two early catchers, but I'm really, really not opposed. How do you guys feel right now about Wilson Contreras being a end of the second round pick?
You mean William?
What did I say?
I think you said Wilson.
Contreras is on the brain.
Yeah. Feels like the right price, but I don't know if I'd be willing to do it that early. It depends on all the other positions. I know in my once I get to March in a 15 team league, if I have an early pick, I really struggle with that 2-3 turn, because it always seems like there's 20 good players, and then actually 20 great players, and then it kind of flattens out for the next like 30 picks or so. So I always struggle with that 2-3 turn where you feel like you're reaching for someone, and I hate putting my KDS there because yes, you're getting a great player, but then it kind of feels like you're losing value in the second and third round. I could see myself drafting it if there's just no starters or other hitters I like, because he does stand out at his position. So if I get to a point where just the outfield, the infielders are kind of flat, and the starters, I feel I can get the same guy at the 4-5 turn, like I could see myself going starting with Contreras, getting closer in Class A and saying, hey, I've got the best closer, the best catcher, and then I'll figure out the rest after that.
It's tough. It almost feels, and maybe I'm projecting, that a round two, round three catcher never works out. It just always seems to flame out, and catchers are so difficult putting that type of capital in, because the injuries, we all know they get dinged up. If they don't go on the IL, their performance suffers sometimes, but Contreras, like Phil said, is hands down the number one catcher. It's definitely too steep for my blood. I actually like Vlad's calling Wilson Contreras earlier, in that he's playing first base. Anytime I can get a guy at catcher eligibility that's not playing catcher, usually more at bats, have a better health, better legs, and hopefully the performance would sustain throughout the year.
The Contreras are just different. Like I was talking to someone earlier, and I really like Wilson Contreras, but I like him more for the fab leagues. I feel like it's a little bit of a risk, especially where he's starting to creep up a little bit. I think he's going to go even higher, and you know, you're spending a fifth round pick in a, you know, I mean, yes, I understand he's moving to first, but just a guy that has perennial injuries. If we knew that he could stay healthy or just had some good track record of health, I mean, he would be going higher anyways. He'd be going probably in the Rutschman range. But I mean, yeah, he's definitely somebody that in gladiators, DCs, I'm a little bit, kind of holding back on. I'll take him like at price, but in a fab league, I'm willing to pay for it. And then William is just, he's insane. I mean, think about a catcher that plays every single day, hits for contact, steal, you know, good batting average, runs an RBI, like he's and steals bases. He's an absolute unicorn. So he really is special. That said, I have yet to just click on him. And he is in that range where it just kind of feels weird. That end of the second round in a 15 teamer, where it's kind of like it's Logan Gilbert, and then it's all these guys that are last year studs who have just completely, you know, risen up into that second round. So it's Ketel Marte and Jackson Merrill and Jaron Duran, and I don't know, I don't see most of those guys earning top 30 overall value.
To go back to Jason's point about injuries with catcher, the tough part about one of the reasons why I'll usually try to only draft one good one with a no seats different, because I think the edge is there. Like, because if they get hurt, you're not dropping him. You're keeping him on your bench. And generally, you have, I don't know, two or three extra bench hitters. So if Mookie gets hurt, you've already got the bench hitters to fill in. If Willian Contreras gets hurt, you have to pick up a catcher. So you're losing you're losing that bench spot for weeks or maybe 2 months, which is really painful. And if you have two good catchers and they both get hurt, even if it's just for 4 weeks, you have to pick up two extra catchers or take a zero there. So that's why the injuries of catcher hurt more. That's why usually like this, despite sometimes with the value we'll say in my sheet, I'll kind of grab the position player first. The non-catcher, for that reason. I made an exception in the OC, like I said, because I think the value is just, it's just worth, and I think in the OC, the roster spots aren't quite as valuable as they are in a main event. Because you can churn from in the bottom of your starting lineup, which you can't do in a main event. So, it's hard to say what I'll do come March, but we'll see. I wish I had a better answer.
It is fascinating because, you know, you get in that dilemma. Your Contreras is out for 8 weeks. You know, it's week five. You're holding on to a zero for 8 weeks on your bench and rostering. You just lose that flexibility and it puts you in really tough decisions. So it is challenging in a 15 and a 12. The replacement cost is that much easier to grab because there's only 24 catchers usually rostered rather than 30. But yeah, it is fascinating. Vlad, you got Ivan Herrera in round 24 in this. Was this before the news that Contreras was going to first base?
No, it was after. It seems like
huge value.
Well, you know, it's actually early. I think I took him about 50 spots ahead of his ADP. I had this paranoia that my team was going to have some issues with batting average, which, I mean, I don't think it's really the case, but because I don't think that Corbin Carroll hits, you know, 237 again. But I just had these guys that aren't like, you know, you don't have that like quintessential 300 hitter. I guess maybe Kyle Tucker could be. Usually doesn't hurt you for average. But I had, you know, Kyle Tucker. The guys that I thought were going to hurt me were like Mark Vientos, Anthony Volpe. I had a couple of those guys. And I don't know, just made a decision there. Let me just, you know, pop an early catcher. I do think Ivan Herrera is massively undervalued. He's a guy that was a very weak sort of slap hitter in the minors and just 1 year made some tweaks, right? I think it was 2 years ago before he came up to the majors, had a really nice season in the minors and started just, you know, squaring up, barreling the ball better, hitting at a higher exit velocity and, you know, translated that into the majors and he's looked really good. And since then, he's been hitting for good average, high contact rates, and even his XBA is like kind of, you know, it's up there. It's not like it's, you know, it's a total fluke. Kind of like if we're getting real dirty with it, Alex Call had a 412, I think, BABIP with like, 324 average. So maybe Alex Call isn't going to be like a, you know, 280 hit or whatever, but that's just me ranting. But yeah, I just like Ivan Herrera. I think he's going to play a lot in that lineup. I don't know how good it's going to be, but you're going to have all these, you know, Wilson Contreras, the veteran. Goldie's not going to be there anymore. Arenado's not going to be there. So all these other guys like Thomas Sagassi and Jordan Walker and Victor Scott, they're going to get a chance to play and maybe put up some stats.
You lost all our OC listeners with Alex Call.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that because I have a pick coming up in the 46th round in my DC, and I've got him starred, and so now he's going to be sniped when I wake up in the morning.
I do got to ask about your Jason Dominguez pick. I was well noted how much I liked him last year, and it never really paid off. You think that's good value? What are you projecting for Dominguez, Vlad, as far as taking him? You know, it's not early, but it's not late either. Yeah. You need him to produce.
He's one of my highest rostered players on all my teams. I don't know what point I'll kind of slow down on drafting Jason Dominguez, but I think it's not quite the Josh Lowe situation from a couple years ago where Lowe is a highly touted prospect and then just completely stunk and then was, you know, like a 30th round guy or undrafted and then just blew up. Obviously, it's a little bit of a different profile here with Dominguez, but, you know, both, you know, first round picks, whatnot. But I don't know, just I haven't, you know, I'm just starting to work through the file. I'm in a month and a half early on where I was at this time last year with starting with projections. Is last year I started in early January. Now I'm starting now. So I haven't gotten there yet, but I just have a very strong gut feel that Jason Dominguez is going to be really good this year. I think it's going to be like a 20-30 guy. Don't know where the average is going to be, but if he, you know, can get up there in the lineup somewhere, maybe 80-80, something like that. We'll see. I don't know, but I do like Jason Dominguez. He's kind of in that group with, you know, Pete Kerr Armstrong and Dylan Cruz, and there are a lot of good outfielders there. And there's also, like, you know, somebody like Adolis Garcia, who sounds like somebody Phil would not take, right, based on the injury news.
That's correct.
Yes, I know.
Phil, Jason Dominguez or Dylan Cruz on the spot?
Neither.
I know Vlad's answer.
Dominguez, though. If I had to choose Dominguez.
And that's just power?
Just because I think I'm going to sound like an idiot because I'm not a prospect guy, but he's younger. He missed the year. I think he's just going to be it feels like this year could be his breakout year. Whereas Cruz was okay in AAA as a 22-year-old. Playing time is pretty much guaranteed. Probably higher floor. But if one guy's going to go off, I think it's Dominguez.
What if, do we think that the Nationals, I don't know how much you guys have looked into this, are going to make a big splash? Like, they're probably not going to sign Juan Soto. It does seem lean like he probably is going to get signed by one of the New York teams, but it feels like they're wanting to make another big splash and get competitive. Obviously, they have some work to do with the rotation, but that's kind of setting up to be a pretty nice young nucleus of hitters. Like, I really like it. I feel like they're just, you know, one or two bats away from being competitive and kind of being like the surprise team there. So I don't know. Have you guys looked into the Nationals and who might be a good fit for them for this offense?
I haven't looked who might be a good fit, but I do expect them to spend. I think with them non-tendering Finnegan, I think I read the payroll is like at 32 million, something like that for this year right now. And like before, they were a competitive team that was spending money. Then they got stuck with the Patrick Corbin contract and the Steven Strasburg contract. So they kind of went down a dark path. But they've always been a team that's been willing to spend to compete. And I think now they have like the piece in place with Abrams, with Wood, with Garcia, with Keibert Ruiz. Jose Tania might always also be something at third base, Dylan Cruz. So they've got like four or five good bats, decent pitching as well, at least some like Mackenzie Gore, forgetting who else, but like they need to add, but like if they sign, I don't know, three or four guys, I think they can be competitive. Maybe not enough to make the playoffs, but they can at least put up a decent team. So they'll be fun to watch and follow, see what they do in the next couple of months.
Yeah, they're that new up and coming, really fun team to watch. I think they ran the most in the majors last year. Every time they're on base, they're running. Other than CJ Abrams, who didn't get on base the second half, but not bitter at all. You know, when you have to save money by cutting Kyle Finnegan, who is actually pretty decent, you know, they might get up to $40 million on the payroll, Phil. you know, a name just to think that would fit there would be like a Nick Pivetta. You know, that undercover ace that would sign. I don't know if it makes complete sense because he did get the qualifying offer, but you know, they're probably in that tier. Maybe a Jack Flaherty. They may probably need two starters if they really want to start competing, because their lineup is definitely coming around. The pitching just has to catch up to it. And then the bullpen on top of that, it'll be interesting how they piece together that bullpen, because they really didn't have any other options after they traded Hunter Harvey away. I think Derek Law was closing or possibly closing every once in a while. It was pretty gross at the back end of that bullpen as well.
They're for sure signing some relievers. They do have a bunch of lefties in the pen. You know, Robert Garcia is pretty solid. I think he was a guy that was a little unlucky last year, but massive, a great arsenal. Look at his, basically a pretty filthy guy. So you got your lefty and your righty with Garcia and Derek Law, but that's not the answer there. I definitely see them going after somebody. It could even be like a Tanner Scott. I can definitely see something like that. Rotation wise, I don't know, like Jake Irvin and Mitchell Parker were great innings eaters last year, but they're just, I don't think they're very good. I think DJ Hers is an up and comer. If he can kind of harness his control, he's somebody that I've been targeting in draft champions. And then Cade Cavalli also, this is a name that we've been drafting in DCs for a couple of years now, just waiting for him to, like, you know, stay healthy, finally be in. So I don't know. There's a lot there, but I definitely see them, like you named it, Jay, the Pavettas, the Flahertys, you know, they'll grab one of those and then maybe like a sort of a lower level, more affordable guy as well, I think, for the rotation.
Jeff Hoffman.
Starter or reliever? What's it going to be?
You know, I was going to ask you about this. One thing I missed the boat on last year was the Crochet and the Ronaldo Lopez's. Got to really dig into these guys that are transitioning from relievers to starters, because the skills, if they translate, really could play up. And that was a really cheap source of, I mean, they won leagues last year, those two guys. So if he does go, I'm definitely interested. I love the Armin Hoffman. So I'm really interested no matter what, unless he goes back to Coors where he started.
Anything else on this draft? You know, we don't want to, like, obviously just like kind of give the cat away, or I don't know what the saying is. I don't know how they say it in Canada. I definitely didn't say it wrong. I didn't say it right in America, but like, let me just say this, that after you took your two catchers, round 7 and 8, and at this point you had four hitters, you had a closer and a starter, which you can name. Like you said, you don't have your guys yet. It's Mason Miller and Framber Valdez. And then you took your two catchers. And then in the next, 11, between rounds 9 and 21, you took basically all pitchers except for two spots. So just two middle infielders. Outside of that, it was like, 11 starters. And so what do you have, six starters or six pitchers on your bench right now and just one?
I think that sounds about right. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. The idea was kind of how I thought, around pick 250 or so. So my round 20 pick was Jose Berríos. Love that. I see that accent there. They always say it like that at the Jays game. So I'm doing my best to.
Man, you nailed that. I didn't realize that you can roll your R's.
Best I ever heard.
So I think he, like him, who else was there? Severino was another one. Like, I thought they were kind of the last two or three guys in a very long tier. So I wanted to get as many of those guys as possible. And just looking at it right now, like Brandon Pfaadt is a good pitcher, but there's some risk to it. I love Kevin Gausman, but he could be a disaster. Mackenzie Gore, you never know. Eovaldi, depends where he ends up signing. So like my pitching, I feel, is really strong, but there's still some risks in there. So I'm happy to have like three or four guys on my bench that I like and I can plug in there. So I'm going through the season in week one with, I know, 9 pitchers that I feel good about, and I can play matchups. And as far as hitters, like, I see, like, if I look at the shortstops, I see, like, Mason Winn, Jeremy Peña, Volpe, Edwards, Rafaela, like, all going, like, round 14 and 15. And then Carlos Correa in round 26, who, my God, like, I know he's an injury risk, but it feels like he can be just as good as those guys. Which I don't think is true for the pitching that I would have gotten in those late rounds. So, like the other hitters I got in the last two rounds, Geloff hoping for a bounce back, Mountcastle with the new left field, Jake McCarthy, Correa, Stanton, who is just a monster in the playoffs, and as long as he's healthy, he can basically be Kyle Schwarber, and then Lars Nubar kind of hoping for a bounce back. Like, it just felt like the hitters I could get there in an OC were just as good as the guys I could have gotten rounds, say, between 12 and 20. So I'm like, might as well just get the pitching early, take some shots late. And I know some of the guys I named are going to be disasters. Like McCarthy could go back to being a platoon or just being part-time player, but I'll just drop him and pick up someone else who's playing every day. So that's kind of the idea. There's a lot of late hitters I like. So just taking shots on those guys and hope I hit. If not, then it's an OC, so it's not so bad. They're pretty easily replaceable.
By the way, thank you real quick for making this the most paused and rewound podcast of all time because of all those names you just named, which, by the way, you claim you do not know if you like them yet, but you just named a bunch of people that people just let's do a study and see if these guys go up in ADP.
He is a market mover, folks. you know, but drafting this early, I mean, it's a good point. There's probably going to be three to five drops before the season starts. So you might as well take your shots. Guys are going to go up in value. As Vlad said, before we kind of got going, you can get huge value, and they're easy drops if they don't work out. Like if McCarthy's in a platoon, unless he's got all righties the first week, Phil's going to drop him. If Stanton's hurt, he's going to drop him. So they're easy drops, easy cuts. And then you just keep churning the roster. So it's definitely interesting strategy to take kind of the upside plays and the pitching and then kind of see how the hitting plays out.
I remember messaging Phil in the middle of that massive pitching run, and he drafted somebody that, you know, of course you're going to look again at somebody. You know, November is not the time to be kind of digging your heels in the ground on certain takes, but it will keep you from not being lazy. And what I mean by that is I noticed that Phil drafted Brandon Pfaadt, and I was an early Pfaadt adopter. Like, he was like just my guy. And then when he first came into the league, all of the pitching gurus were like, oh, his fastball shape and this and that. And remember, he was getting killed. He had just lots of homers and stuff in his rookie year, and it wasn't a great year. And then last season, he had some nice games, some good stretches, but also I just remember the only place I had him in was in TGFBI. And I was just benching him a lot. There was just nothing. I didn't love it. And at the end of the day, the great Brandon Pfaadt had an ERA near 5. And so that's what was kind of stuck in my mind. And, you know, before I've started the projection process, I've kind of almost like made an opinion on it, which is the wrong way to do it. And so just Phil drafting him made me just kind of look back into him. And at some point I would have looked into Pfaadt again, but I'm looking back and like, oh, okay. 2 walks per 9, like a very low, he reduced his walk rate. His swinging strike rate is still above 11%. He has an XFIP and Sierra that's like a full run and a half lower than his ERA. I mean, and he's been consistent and healthy and pitched 180 innings last year. So there's a lot to like there. So it's just, you know, I'm not going to all of a sudden bump him up 3 rounds or whatnot, but it just like, it's keeping me honest, I guess you can say, and making me kind of dig in and having all the information instead of just going off of biases.
Yeah, I don't have like a super detailed analysis on Pfaadt, but like he went like in 2022, 166 innings, 156 in 2023, 181 last year. He's still only 26 years old. It's gonna be his third season of majors. Like you said, like there was, I don't like to call it bad luck because like, yes, his metrics outperformed his ERA. So there is some bad luck involved, but there's also some bad pitches in there. But I think there's something to that. Like his third season in the majors, still at 26. He's always like had pretty good stuff. So I think there's adjustments to be made. And I think he's one of those guys who, if he puts it together, he could be like a 3.4, 3.5 ERA kind of guy. Like Giolito was younger, but it took him like, I would say it's at like 24, 25. He had that breakout season, and he was that highly touted prospect who really struggled in the first few seasons, and he kind of just put it all together. So not saying Pfaadt is going to be like that, but there is some adjustment to be made with young pitchers. And I think he especially struggled with, in terms of ERA, at least in the second half of the season. So it might have been either him tipping pitches or just being too predictable. So like, who knows, but he seems like a guy who could bounce back because of his skills and his age.
Yeah. And where you get the big value in these drafts is that prospect fatigue, guys that ever be like last year before and didn't do anything. You know, these guys get better. It doesn't happen overnight. And, you know, they're human beings. They mature differently. They lifestyles, coaching, how they take to it. You know, the breakout point for pitchers used to be in the mid to late 20s. And now we're expecting to come up at 22, 23 and just dominate. So maybe there's something to that, you know, age 26 season. I remember, I think it was the end of the, not last season, the one before, he switched sides of the rubber and it made a big impact. You know, where he stood on the mound, that didn't really translate a ton to last year. But like you said, the first half was good. So maybe just ran out of gas. Maybe was fighting an injury, tipping pitches. So really interesting analysis. So kind of what you're looking at. So I really like that. And I also really like Vlad's pick of Robbie Ray coming off year two off an injury. We were all picking him in the third round a couple of years ago before the injury. And I think that really could pay off being a Giants fan and just kind of watching him pitch last year and him getting his feet back under him going into this year.
So fun. I just, Jay, you got to jump in, man. The water's warm. It's so nice.
There's no chance of me doing a CLQ right now, Vlad. I might.
No, I just mean a gladiator.
I'm in a gladiator.
You are?
I'm in my second gladiator. So I did a three pack because you gave me the addiction. You passed it on to me. So I'll see you at our meetings. I want to get all my rankings done before really starting the OCs and the DCs because I want to have a purpose behind the draft. And it's so easy once I start and there's no stopping, so there's no break. So once I get in that first DC or now these slow OCs, it's really hard to, you know, put the pause button on.
So we're going to go a little extended here. It is late, so we're not going to be doing this all night, but there are a couple other things. One more topic I wanted to talk to you guys about is just the closers. And before that, just a couple of questions I have about some recent signings. But just real quick on the housekeeping stuff that I meant to do earlier in the show. I think I mentioned last week the FTN Fantasy Draft Guide, the baseball draft guide with our full team. The full team is back. Officially on board every single person. And our draft guide is going to come out on December the 17th. That's a Tuesday. I updated BDP rankings. Right now they're still top 300. I'll move them into a 500 here in the next couple weeks. And then also I'm getting going on the underdog ranking. So I'm also, to add to the madness, I'm in four underdog slow drafts right now because the way too early contests have opened up. And so I'll prepare the underdog rankings as well. And then just a mention, Larry Schechter, who is a fantasy Hall of Famer, one of the great guys in the industry who's just been winning. He's kind of like the Phil way before Phil, in the 90s and the early 2000s, like won the Diamond Challenge with like 40,000 plus people a couple times and, Tout Wars champ several times and NFBC. He has a great book out. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend that you check it out. It's called The History of Fantasy Sports, The History of Fantasy Sports and the Stories of the People Who Made It Happen. It's phenomenal. It's a fantastic read. It's really quick. And it just kind of, just gives you, especially if you've read, Fantasyland and the Chandler books, those are great. They're more baseball focused. This is different. This kind of gives you the whole, like, the first guys back in the bars in Oakland that were, that started fantasy football in the drafts and just like the greatest stories ever all about the history of our sport. So if you're into that stuff and you are probably because you're listening to this podcast, check it out. I'm not getting paid for it. This ad, anything, I'm not getting no cut. It's just because I read it. It's a phenomenal book. You can get it on Amazon, Larry Schechter's The History of Fantasy Sports. All right. Real quick on Kikuchi. We kind of touched on that. Let me ask you about Jonathan India and Brady Singer trade. How does that move the needle for you guys one way or the other?
Leaving Grademacher in ballpark was never great for a hitter. He had four home runs on the road last year, so it feels kind of this might kill his power. Kansas City's great place for scoring, but not so much for home runs. So I think the average is probably going to go up. I could see him kind of not quite the same average, but maybe kind of a bit like a Stephen Kwan type of guy, like a 10 home run, 15 to 20 stolen base with like a 280 average. Haven't done the math on the park yet, but I think Kansas City being great for average, I think that could help him. And leading off in front of Bobby Witt, which seems kind of the plan right now, is going to be good for scoring runs as well. So. Not a terrible move, just hurt his power, just makes him a different player.
Yeah, more valuable in the 15s and the 12s. If he is leading off, there is some interest at the cost, but you never loved leaving a Great American Small Park because the Reds did have a good lineup. India's biggest issue is his health, not only his power, but, can he stay on the field? But it feels like there could be a lot of runs scored. in that lineup, especially if he's leading off. But it's going to be probably a tough click for me. And, you know, is it me or does Brady Singer feel like it should? It's like a trap. Like we're just going to avoid him, and he's going to go to Cincinnati and deal now, kind of like what Nick Martinez this year or last year. It just feels like, oh, I have no interest, and he's going to go have a 3-4 ERA, 16 wins, 180 strikeouts.
That's exactly the thought I had, because I was into Brady Singer last year, and it was good for a little bit. It was good for the first half after the All-Star break. It was horrific. But you know, as soon as he went to Cincinnati, you're like, okay, all bets off, and we don't even think twice about it. And that's exactly what the kind of thing that'll happen. Everything you said, Phil, I agree with. I think that's pretty much on point with Jonathan India. The one thing to me, it's not an intangible because it is a tangible, but the fact that he could potentially be leading off ahead of Bobby Witt for so long. I mean, every projection system is going to under project his runs. Like it's massive. So you're right. Like a Kwan type with 10-20, I think is on point with, you know, with a lower average. I like it. What about, I mean, I don't even want to bring this up, but like, you know, Kyle Farmer signs with the Rockies. They non-tendered Brendan Rodgers, who promises that to steal 20 bases 4 years ago and didn't even attempt one that one season. But I guess it's not even that Farmer's going to be playing much. I mean, he's a platoon guy against lefties. But I guess they're going to give Aaron Shunk a chance. This is too much depth for a November show, isn't it?
Hey, I had a small rant on this. I actually think Farmer's going to play every day, because if the Rockies are paying someone about $4 million, I think their plan is to play him every day. I just think this exact move by the Rockies shows what's wrong with baseball right now. Like, Rodgers has been like a decent player, played for minimum salary for 3 years, then made, I think it was 2.7 and 3.2 million. Then when he's supposed to make about 5 or 6 million arbitration, they non-tender him and pick up a guy who's going to be 2 million cheaper, who's basically the same player. At least when you look at the last 3-4 years, they've been very similar. Maybe Farmer's a little bit better defensively, but they're basically the same player. So the Rockies are saving about $2 million that way. It just seems wrong that, and like we saw this coming a mile away, like at the last CBA where the players didn't do much to fix arbitration, didn't do much to fix the first 3 years that players have to play at minimum salary, unless the really good players get a bonus. But it's just like teams are going to keep doing this. We saw with Finnegan, with Romano, because they think they might be worth 5 or 6 million instead of the 8 or 9 they'd make it in their last year of arbitration. So they just non-tender them, and they plan to sign a reliever to save those three million maybe. So it's annoying, but players only have themselves to blame for it, and it's never going to change because someone like Brendan Rodgers has no power in the MLBPA. So it's stupid. It's annoying. It's always going to be that way. And he's going to keep taking advantage of things like this.
And he has no power in the ballpark too. It seems like that's why he got DFA'd. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, echoing Phil's points. It's the haves and have nots of baseball, and the have nots are doing anything they can to save those $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. And it's hard. It's gotta be hard as a fan watching that. You have no loyalty to your players. You know, I got in kind of an argument with my buddy. We're both Giants fans, and the Giants signed Mike Yastrzemski to, I think, $9.6 million, which is probably too expensive for the player. But, you know, he's been a good player. He's a fourth outfielder, and that's what the arbitration number was going to be. So they signed it. Now he's on the payroll. And I would rather see that as a fan than trying to save money. And, you know, you watch this kid come up through your system and Brendan Rodgers, and he was one of your top prospects, and he struggled, and he's fought through injuries, and then, okay, sorry, you're going to sign your older, cheaper version here that the fans don't know or really care about.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I like the fact you guys brought that up, and it also kind of reminds me, I know this is probably not the same, but like when someone starts off your fantasy football auction with like the dollar kicker, you know, I don't know, just or defense or whatever.
I'm doing that next year now, Vlad.
Yes. Another one last thing I want to ask you guys about. There's a report from Sean McAdam of MassLive.com regarding Rafael Devers that the Red Sox are having internal discussions, but moving him off of third base and basically having him and Tristan Casas swap at first base and DH. Devers has been pretty poor defensively over the last couple seasons and also dealing with some nagging shoulder injuries on both sides. So thinking about that move for him, obviously good for the fantasy eligibility, a little more flexibility there. But all of this kind of lining up, we know the Red Sox are going to make some big moves, but just to be able to move someone to third base or sign someone on third base, whether that be an Alex Bregman, maybe Willie Adames, who can move over and play third, or maybe a Nolan Arenado. Though the Arenado thing is interesting because he also said today that he would kind of like, would be okay to move to first, which is pretty much like, hey, San Diego, my home state, come take me.
Well, Arenado is so bad, I think he'll say anything to get on a good team right now.
That report just makes no sense, though. Like, so Devers clearly said he wants to play third base. So you're going to upset the guy who got signed for 9 more years, have him swap with Casas at first base and DH. Yoshida, who you still owe, $50 million for the next 3 years, is not going to have a regular spot, or you're going to put him in the outfield where he doesn't really belong. It just seems so odd. I don't see why they'd even consider that. I could see them signing Bregman or Adames to play second base. And then if whatever happens during the season, if Devers is still struggling with the shoulder, then they can move one of those guys to the third. They can put Rafaela back at second base and they kind of move guys around to make it fit. But trading for Arenado to put him at third, move upset Devers by moving him to first, not having a spot for Yoshida, just doesn't make sense to me. I can internal discussions. It's just like, is it just like one intern throwing it around and say, hey, why don't we do this? No, we shouldn't. And then it's so vague. You don't know what the actual discussions were. But it doesn't make sense to me.
It sure seems like a November baseball article. There was nothing else to write about, so they kind of just threw some stuff against the wall. But the only good side to it is that Tristan Casas would have more opportunity DHing to paint his nails in the clubhouse or in the dugout between innings.
He's a quirkster, that's for sure. Let's see. I mean, right now I've got him, right around ADP, maybe even a little lower, but I would really love for him to have that massive season that that many of us were expecting last year. And I wonder what these couple pieces are going to be for the Red Sox, because they're going to be making some moves. They got money to spend. They're going to go for it. I think they're in for a big splash. I think they might be part of something even shocking. Not that I have any intel on anything like that, but I think it'll be really, really, really fun. By the way, Tyler O'Neill, where is he going to end up? Will he end up in your hometown or nearby?
I love it. I'd love for Tyler O'Neill and Nick Pivetta to come home and to Canada and play in Toronto. I think they'd both be great fits. The Jays need a power bat. They have DH open. It's perfect for him. And they look like they're willing to spend some money. I'd love it. I don't know if it's going to happen. The way they handle the Romano thing is kind of annoying, even though I get the move. They saw him pitch in Florida. They're not sure about his health. I get it, but it's just annoying that the Canadian kid who grew up cheering for the Jays and was a closer for the last 4 years or so, is just gone now and is upset at the team. So I don't think there's any chance that he's coming back for less money. It kind of goes back to your Yaz story with the Giants. You kind of just wish they'd overpay for him, even though it's probably not the best business decision. I think it just would have made sense.
Yeah, it really makes me question his health coming into the year that they would do that. Because the Jays do spend money. They're not. They're one of the more wealthy teams with the Rogers network, having the backing of it. So It is a shame having a hometown kid. It really is. But I don't know if Tyler O'Neill on artificial turf is a good combination, Phil. That sounds like a recipe for 41 games a year.
Just a good point. With DH, doesn't have to play the outfield.
Well, don't you have to run on the artificial turf in the infield when you get a hit?
He can jog around.
I mean, he does anyway.
God, yeah. He needs to go to those yoga classes with Judge and Stanton. Pilates, baby.
By the way, I got a question today. Somebody was in a Gladiator that hit me up, and they were in the final round, and they were looking for they wanted to grab a third closer, and they said Romano was still there. If they should still pick him, I said no. Don't pick it. Don't even draft Romano in a Gladiator. Is that good advice?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends who else was on the board, but I think now that he's not with the Jays, I don't really see him getting at least a locked-in closer opportunity. I could easily see him just blowing up from three innings with a 5 or 6 ERA. It's hard because we don't have the information. I want to trust the Jays and say they made the decision because he's not healthy, but it's also very possible that in their mind he wasn't worth the $9 million. He was only worth 5 or 6, and they chose to let him go just because of that. So we're kind of guessing, and if we're guessing, I'd rather go another route.
Yeah. Is who would you say as a Jays fan, if they don't bring somebody in from the outside, would be the closer start the year?
Swanson.
Okay.
Good to know. There goes somebody's so he didn't even get, so by the way, so I'm working on this thing. I think you guys are familiar with our with the filth metric for pitchers repertoires that our data guy Frank Brink created. So I'm working on a little something for the draft guide. I'll keep it as like a tool where basically I'm taking all relievers after 250 ADP and basically grading them out on their overall like arsenal, their sort of closer, possibility or like high leverage possibility, and kind of grading them. And so I'm going to write an article around that too. And it's helping me in my research. So I'm kind of identifying, the next guys, like who are the guys that are like really good values and worth, drafting. Like one of my discoveries through this is that Cole Sands is phenomenal, really good pitcher for the Twins, and could, just continue to, if something happens to John Duran, and if they move Griffin Jacks into the rotation, which I heard is a possibility, then somebody like Cole Sands could end up with, some saves. It also made me realize, and the reason for this question, as I keep rounding abouting, is that Chad Green apparently doesn't have the filthiest stuff. So I don't know. That's just something I had noticed. So that's interesting that you said Eric Swanson, because
I think that the thing with Swanson is he was dominant for at least his last year in Seattle, first year in Toronto. Last year in spring training, his kid got hit by a car. And it messed with his mind, and he was off. He was terrible for the first 3 months for obvious reasons. And then July 20th, he went down to AAA and came back July 20th, 3.54 xFIP, 2.55 ERA the last 24 innings he threw. So he was back to the guy he was the 2 years before. They avoided arbitration, signed him for $3 million for a year. And before last year, he was the eighth inning guy, and he was the replacement for Romano. So I think he's the guy going to training camp, unless they bring in someone else. But for now, he's the guy I put my money on.
They are paying him, right, Phil? Like, he's not cheap.
Sorry, say that again.
They are paying Swanson a decent amount of money, right? He's not,
it's
like
$3 million.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not a lot of money.
One-year deal. And that's not a great bullpen, by the way, just in general. Just looking at the guys behind Chad Green, Eric Swanson at this point. It's like, Zach Pop, Tommy Nance, Hagen Donner. Never heard of him, but I'm sure he makes a good vanilla almond.
Did you mean Hagen Doss?
Well, that's my vanilla almond.
They do need to add like at least like 3 bullpen arms. Yeah. So whether one of those is like a Kyle Finnegan that they bring in for the 9th, and they say you have Swanson for the 8th, and they have Chad Green as kind of the the swingman role for sixth and seventh inning, that's very possible. And even a couple years ago, I'm pretty sure they were, I mean, there were some discussions about signing, even when Romano was there, about signing Jansen. I think Hendricks was part of the rumors. Iglesias might have been, they were rumored to either make him an offer or trade for him at some point. So they've kind of always wanted to bring in another closer. So whether they go into season with Swanson at the guy as the guy, it might be 50-50. But as a late DC play or even a late Gladiator, because I think the ratios are going to be there now that the personal stuff is out of the way. And his son's doing good apparently. So as now that that stuff is out of the way, I think the ratios are going to be there. So maybe you draft him like last round Gladiator, thinking you're going to get a 3 ERA with maybe 5 or 10 saves and hope for more.
So, but what if somebody happens to be goes on the clock in the 46th round of a DC while he's on a podcast with friends, but he doesn't need any more relief pitchers and Eric Swanson is there? What does he do?
You never have too many relief pitchers, Vlad, take him.
Yeah. All right. Nice. Thanks, guys. Let's see what we will go back to this moment here. And it's perfect that we're talking about this because we're going to end the show with just a little bit of a closer discussion. And, specifically, I wanted to ask you both how we all know that the closers are being or at least the set guys, like the guys that we just know are solid, you know, set until they're not. But the Devin Williams's, Edwin Diaz's, Josh Hader's of the world, Emmanuel Clase's, obviously, these guys are going higher in drafts now in non-fab leagues than they will a little later when we get into February, March, the OCs, the main events and everything. And so we all kind of know that, but I wanted to ask your opinions on the two types of non-fab leagues we're doing now, the draft champions with the 50 rounds and the bench moves versus the gladiators and 23 no bench. How are you looking into approaching closers differently in those two formats?
I'd be more likely to target closers in gladiators because let's take Luke Weaver, for example. If he doesn't close in a gladiator, he's not killing you. You're likely getting great ratios. So even if it's a middle round pick, you're getting possibly 80 innings of sub 3 ERA with, I don't know, 5 to 10 wins, maybe 5 saves, something like that, which isn't a bad pick for – is it round 10 of gladiators? If you get that in the DC when you're expecting saves from that spot, you could be losing 4, 5, 6 roto points because someone else is going to hit on the late closers. And there's always teams that end up with 80, 90 saves. But if you lose that early closer in the DC, it really hurts. It's happened to me in the past with Edwin Diaz. Was it 2 years ago? And I think it's a 1K DC we actually had together, Vlad.
Yep.
So I think those just kill you in a DC. So I'm more likely to pay up for the top closers in a DC, and then in the middle rounds, more likely in gladiators than in DCs. And I think one other question you have that I'll kind of just go through quickly. There's right now, as far as free agents, there's Yates, Jansen, Estevez, Aroldis Chapman, Tanner Scott, Finnegan, Romano, and Clay Holmes, all of whom have pretty significant closing experience. So if we say that like the top 10 closers are pretty safe, and there is maybe 5 teams at the bottom who probably won't sign anyone with no chance of signing one of those guys, it means there's like maybe, I'm going to say like 4 or 5 of these guys who are going to close, who can close for maybe 15 teams. So there's like a 25, 30, 35% chance that whoever you're drafting in those middle rounds, whether it's Weaver, Hodge, who else going those rounds? Like whoever else, Brian Walker, a bunch of those, Lucas Ursig, like all those guys, I think there's a 25, 30% chance that they won't be closing come opening day. They could get the job back and whatnot. But for me, that's way too risky to be risking like around 10, 12, 15 pick in a DC where every pick is so important.
Unfortunately, nobody can see the video other than us, but Vlad got really stressed out when you said Lucas Erceg.
I did. I love a Lucas Erceg, by the way. No, I just want to say, dude, this is exactly why I love having you on the show, talking to you about this stuff, because what seems like common, like just the kind of like the, how do I put this? What feels like the right path or what is common sense, you just debunked and it made a lot of sense. And your robot mind just went, bunk, 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 and you know, that's not the right sound for robots, obviously. But with the math there, like, yeah, dude, that makes a lot of sense. Like I'm also thinking back to when I lost Blake Treinen several years ago and, you know, with a fourth round pick, or like, you know, getting killed by Edwin Diaz and Devin Williams last year. And how you almost kind of you kind of bank on those. You're like, oh, I got the, you know, 40 saves or whatever. And so you peel back, you kind of hang back on the saves, and then you end up getting screwed in the DCs. And it's a much bigger field there. It's like 5,000 teams where a lot of people are going to get some late saves. And yeah, what you just said made a lot of sense, man. So I really appreciate that you brought that up.
And one more thing about DCs is when you lose, it's the one thing I noticed with Diaz is when you lose a guy like that you plug in every week, it means you need to find an eighth starting pitcher or that reliever that you drafted in around 50, 45 or 50 that you're kind of hoping is going to have the ratios. But just having to find, we're in a fab league, you can kind of replace them, glad you just don't replace. But having to find an SP8 in a DC gets really tough. So it kills you in terms of saves and ratios, which is doubly painful when you lose a guy like that.
Yeah, and that is why Phil is the best. Don't want to make his head too big. He might not fit through the door, but we love him. And thanks for dropping that knowledge for us, Phil. And I mean, back to your question, Vlad, I haven't really done great in the Gladiators, but I think I did one last year and did three the year before, so it's not like a lot of volume, but definitely prioritizing closers earlier than the DCs just to get that locked in, hopefully get those 30 saves, 40 saves with the ratios and the Ks. You know, it's funny, in the DCs, the fad, and I think Phil might have started this a couple years ago, was to push up the closers, and the price got extremely expensive on the top closers. I'm round one, round two wraps on the, you know, the four honeys and the 1K DCs. And, you know, the mindset's kind of flipping back now where it's harder to put that high capital in the closer. So it's just interesting to watch the evolution of the ADP and the big drafts and how those work, how the people think. And, you know, it seems like whenever you're against the herd, you know, when you're not groupthink, that's when you have success. So you got to kind of figure out where the groupthink's going and try to go the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, just that whole, all these guys that we're talking about, like you mentioned Luke Weaver, there's Michael Kopech. I mean, these guys are going 150, 180. I mean, that's, you know, pretty high draft capital, no matter where you look at it, without any real confidence that they are the closers. These are both major market teams that could very easily, you know, they could do a committee thing. They can bring, you know, bring someone else in. There are a lot of closers on the market, and maybe somebody like Luke Weaver, you know, we were talking to our guy, Mike Mager, who, you know, seems to think that Luke Weaver's, you know, obviously really kind of redefined himself after just not being anything special all these years and as a starter. And then that he really is better suited as like a multi-inning setup guy than he is a closer. And so it's really hard to spend that, you know, 9th, 10th round pick on somebody like that. And there's just so many guys like that. Like I can't see myself clicking on Justin Martinez. It's not just the fact that he had a little control problems or high whip or whatever. Like, I just don't know. I don't know even there, like, does he have the job? And AJ Puck is there and they could, you know, mix things up. And there's just so many of those type of guys where I just catch myself, you know, playing the what if game way too much on these closers. And it's such a dangerous game. And so that's why I kind of start to lean more on the high leverage, the skills, the stuff, the arsenal, and all that kind of, all those kind of things.
Yeah, I think that's the way to do it. I think you can speculate on skills in rounds 35, 40. You'll get a guy that's as skilled as Justin Martinez, who isn't really on anyone's radar, but who, I mean, it's November 26th, like season starts in 4 months, then it's a long season. Like, a lot of things could change. So I'd rather speculate on that guy, pick pick 600 that were where I love the skills than on Justin Martinez, because he had some sleeves late last year and we think he's the closer right now, but like so much could happen.
Yeah, draft skills this time of year, not role. And just touching base on Luke Weaver, and maybe this is just me watching the playoffs and World Series, but I would be hard pressed to not see him as the closer next year in New York with how Aaron Boone used him and leaned on him in those big moments. He trusted him, just absolutely above anybody else in that bullpen. And as good as the Tanner Scotts is and the Kenley Jansen and Jeff Hoffman, I don't see them bringing in somebody that Boone would trust more than him in those big moments. Now, he could go to high leverage, which Vlad said the multi-inning and Mager mentioned, but it was interesting. He did reinvent himself, and all the skills and the stats kind of support it. And it was really interesting in the pitch mix. He dumped his slider and his curveball, basically. He went down to 1% on each, and the K rate spiked. The K minus walk, 23.3%, 2.87 Sierra. For me, watching as much baseball as I do, he passed the eye test. So he's definitely somebody I'm interested in, depending on the price. Again, I'm not really doing many big drafts now, but if I had to bet, he's the closer in New York next season.
I like it. It's great to see, especially think back to, the St. Louis days and what he was, and to see him on that big stage was phenomenal. Let me ask you guys just kind of wrapping things up here about three guys. You can mention any one of them or not. But I love the man, Liam Hendricks. I can't seem to feel confident that he's going to be fine and healthy and the Red Sox closer and all that. So I just have not been clicking on him. Wanted to also ask you about Ryan Walker and his soaring price. And I'm sure Jason's curious too, because, being a Giants guy and what's going to happen to Camilo Duval, I guess, is a follow-up question there. And then also David Bednar, because the man just fell apart. I mean, he was like, a year and a half ago, we're like, oh, if he was on the Yankees, he'd be the best closer in baseball, this and that. And then just hurt last year. He was bad. Aroldis Chapman was getting saves. Every time Bednar got more opportunities, he just kept blowing it. So something was definitely off with him last year. So just any thoughts on any of those three guys?
Hendricks, the last time we saw him where he was dominant was 2022, and 3 years is a long time in baseball. It's getting up there. I mean, he could win the job in spring training, but the way the Red Sox are looking to spend right now, being on Soto, bringing a third baseman, I mean, they're looking to spend, and I don't see how they go into the season with Hendricks as their closer. Maybe they just bring in, like Romano and Finnegan, where they have options, and if Hendricks wins it, then he's the guy. If not, they have other options. But I the way where he's going right now, I'm not interested. Ryan Walker, I love the skills. If he's still going there in spring training and nothing has changed, I'll be very interested. And I think out of like those guys going in that range, I mean, Jason can correct me if I'm wrong, I just don't get the feeling that the Giants are going to sign a Jansen or a Yates to take his job. So I think Walker might be one of the most likely to keep his job. And then who is the other? Bednar, no interest. We're kind of just, where he's going right now, we're kind of betting on him being magically healthy, which he wasn't at all last year. It's not like, I'll bet on the guy who had like a 4x fit with a 6 ERA, thinking, hey, the skills aren't that bad. He had some bad luck and maybe just a few bad pitches, but Bednar was just bad all around, and betting on him, especially like I could make that pick in an OC where he's an easy drop if he hasn't improved. But in a DC, those picks are so important. And even in Gladiator, where you don't want to get stuck with a 5 or 6 ERA. I just have no interest in him where he's going, which is, I think it's what, around pick 250 or so. Yeah. No, actually, even pick 200, the last, even worse.
190, 200.
Yeah. Yeah. You're betting on a bounce back. And I get it. Like, it's a 150 DC. You're shooting for the overall and willing to take some chances. But I think there's just so many more, like Tommy Edman going at 202 right after him, like different position. But I think he is just as much upside as Bednar at a different position. I just don't see the need to gamble on a closer like that, who's terrible. Who's terrible last year.
Well, and it's interesting. Everybody's assuming he had an injury. Like, his fastball velocity was actually up. So there was not necessarily an arm issue. The skills declined rapidly last year. Now, was it an injury? Was it something personal? We don't know. But like Phil said, to bet on a bounce back without any data behind it, it's a big draft cost there to kind of go with the ifs. Now, it could be a big payoff, but I don't think it's a lot of fantasy skill. If that hits, it's more of a coin flip and you got lucky. So it could work out. To Phil's question about the Giants, and obviously I don't know what's going on in behind the scenes, but with Buster Posey there, I don't think there's any chance of them drafting or signing a closer. So they're going to be going in with Walker. I think there's a really, really high probability Doval gets traded and he's closing somewhere else. You can
Marlins.
See you can see a Toronto possibly fitting. Now, I don't know if they'll trade him early because the value has not been lower. I was championing them to trade him last year before opening day when his value was high, but the arm is elite. So there will be a team that does fall in love with him. So I do think Camille Duvall will have a chance to close somewhere this year. Ryan Walker was filthy last year, and watching those games, I mean, he was dominant, but he scares me. Having a pop-up guy, basically a two-pitch pitcher, through 80 innings, and you know, I kind of have a hard rule that kind of it's been working for me, is anything over 70 innings a year before, they kind of flame out the following year. Their arm doesn't handle it. It scares me, but his CSW was higher than Edwin Diaz, higher than Devin Williams, you know, higher than all of those top tier. So he was really, really good. But you know, if he loses that sinker a little bit, loses an, you know, an inch of ride or whatever it is, that could blow up pretty quick. So I'm going to be, unfortunately, probably not drafting any Ryan Walker. And I am interested in Liam Hendricks. The contract, how they signed him, was that 2-year deal, one to get healthy and one to close. We have no idea if he's any good anymore. I guess that a lot of that's going to be spring training and how he looks, but I'll be definitely eyes open to him.
Yeah, I was looking up. Ryan Walker had some absolute filth last season. You're right. It was, I mean, you look at, you know, Stuff Plus, the filth, it's all like, I think similar scores. We're pulling mapping to different, you know, a little bit different stats, but, you know, like two of his pitches grading out at like, you know, 130 plus, which is pretty impressive. It's up there among the elite. And of course, sample was decent. I mean, he pitched a lot of innings last year. I do want to report officially that I did make the Eric Swanson pick. So the 44th round, Eric Swanson, and that was pick 658. And I was excited to report to you guys the new min pick for Eric Swanson. And then I go and I check ADP. He's got an ADP of 734, which is the, you know, 50th round or 49th round. He hasn't been drafted in like half of them, but his min is 441.
That was somebody. Actually, that was a CLQ.
I wish. My DCCLQ finished before the Romano news came out. So otherwise, I would have been all over that pick.
I think we need some type of clapping background or something. Vlad, can you pipe that in at this point in the pod?
Yeah. Listen, Govier is the only guy I know who can do the side effects in a pod. I'm sure it's a few buttons, but can't do that. Anything else as we wrap things up? Anything we didn't cover? Just one last quick touch on this guy, because I remember we were fighting for him in a main event a couple years ago, Phil. But the wanderer who is the great Drew Rasmussen, and what will he be for us this year? We know he will be good if he's healthy, like really good, but what will his role be? And do we just draft him and just whatever we get, we get?
The Rays are hard to predict, but if I had to guess, I think they'll use him as like a 4-inning follower and kind of pace his maybe the 120, 130 innings. They want him to pitch like that. I don't see them doing like the White Sox with Crochet, where they go all in for 3 months and then just shut him down and bring him down to 2 or 3 innings. I that's the smartest path, and it's a path that they've used before, and they might even need to do that with pretty much all their starting pitchers with Springs and with McClanahan coming back. So I think we might see a lot of openers, a lot of maybe pairing two of those guys together to go 7 and 8 or 8 innings. So it kind of comes down, is it the starter who goes 3 or 4 innings, or is it the follower who goes 4 innings? Could be a 10 to 12 win difference. It might be a mix of the two. But a guy going, what is it, around pick 250 right now, something like that, yeah, 260, mm-hmm. Who has a 2.95 career ERA in 310 innings, who's pretty much always been good when he's pitching, at least since 2021. It might just be one of those where you take a shot and just use him wherever, and you take those 120 innings of great ratios, and hope the wins could come with it.
Yeah, I hate to tease, but or just give it away, but I think I was looking at I went and looked at the overall filth score for every reliever past ADP 250, and I think he was like 1 or 2. So it's insane. But what you're telling me is that like Manuel Rodriguez and Kevin Kelly are going to lead this team in wins, huh?
It's possible. I mean, the Rays have always kind of gotten creative with the rotation. They moved away a little bit from that. Was it 2 years ago when they had like enough guys? But now with all these guys coming back, with guys like Taj, like Boz, that you don't fully know about the health. I think they might just have like 7 starting pitchers and kind of just get them to go. Some of them might go 5 or 6, but a lot of them go 3 or 4, and get their innings that way.
I mean, they even moved your former boy, Zach Littell. Even Roster Resources showing him outside the rotation right now. And that dude's been like legit solid for a couple of years now.
I cannot claim him as my boy.
He was a Giant. That's why I said that. He used to be a Giant.
But I will be drafting Drew Rasmussen a lot at the current cost. I think there's a non-zero chance he does get, 15, 20 saves as well, if he's not starting. But either role he's going to be in should be valuable. At the cost, unless, he gets that crazy helium he did 2 years ago before the injury where nobody could draft him soon enough. I think he was going like the 5th or 6th round, him in Springs, by the time we were in Vegas that year. That was truly nuts. I'll be targeting him.
I think for the Rays, whatever the Tigers did last year, they had Skubal going 7 innings every 3 days, every 5 days, mm-hmm. and the rest of the rotation was kind of just guys going 3 or 4 innings, with a lot of high velo, high good tough pitchers. I think you can kind of see the Rays doing that this year, just having 1 or 2 regular guys and just mixing in, never knowing who's going to start when, but just using it that way, and the end result was great for the Tigers. So kind of expecting something similar for the Rays.
Well, look at this, an hour and a half more. It just flew by. This has been like one of the most riveting conversations. I would absolutely love to keep it going if it wasn't like, whatever it is, midnight at this time. But I mean, Phil, if we can maybe get you before you officially turn into the robot and go into like full draft mode, if we have you on the show sometime in the next couple months, we would absolutely love it.
Yeah, for sure. I'd love to. I love just talking to you guys, and the two of you are two of my favorite people. I look forward to seeing and hanging out with in Vegas, eating dumplings. So hopefully we can do that again in 4 months from now. So it was great talking to you guys, and anytime you want to have me on, I'd love to.
Don't forget the sake, Phil.
I'm not doing that again this year.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Some of the best dumplings out there. We've got so many more months of drafts to go, strategy, conversations. It's going to be so much fun. We're not even done with 2024 yet, but draft season is full swing, full underway. Very happy to have our friend Phil do so on for the show. So thank you so much, Phil, for coming on. For Jason Anthony, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.